The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Sky. Watch Premier League, Women's Super League, EFL, Scottish Premiership, and much more. Live on Sky Sports.
I'm prepared to anything I can. Well, to do it then.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Hey, welcome along to the Football Show. Joe Malloy with you this evening. Later on, Joseph Ndoh is going to talk to us about the Africa Cup of Nations. In the meantime, very happy to bring in, because it has been a big day in Irish football for the FAI, Dion Fanning, Associate Editor at The Currency. Dion, great to have you with us.
Hey Joe, how's it going?
Very well. So two things broadly happening today. One, Ireland not going for the World Cup 2030, but very much part of the bid for the Euros of 2028. That was this morning's big conversation. And just in the last couple of hours this evening, the FAI have launched a strategy plan 2022 to 2025 on their own YouTube channel, and they've put a report into the public domain as well. So it's been a big old day. We might start with the Euro 2028 bid. So they have parked the 2030 plan. I seem to remember reading in various places mid last year, that the 2030 World Cup bid was never going to win. There was a general acceptance and understanding that it would not be heading the way of Ireland and the UK, and that 2028 was very much a realistic possibility if the bid could turn its attention that way. And it seems that's where we are.
Yeah, that was... That was the feeling in all quarters, I think, when the 2030 project was floated, and the 2028, for lots of reasons, seems to be much more possible and much more likely. It doesn't stop it being seen by many people as a kind of an expensive waste of time, and that there are far more important, more important issues in Irish football to deal with than getting a major tournament to the country. I'm not so sure it's an either or, really. Like I think there's, and it's an interesting thing, and it actually does feed in a little bit into the strategy document. We will come back to that. But there are a number of different football communities in Ireland, as we all know, and they aren't necessarily all they're not necessarily always overlapping. And there's a huge amount of participation. There's a huge amount of interest in the Irish national team, and then there is a devoted developed domestic league, and ignored and badly marketed, but domestic league. And somehow there has to be a way of actually trying to do things that engages all of those people. Ideally, it happens through a really vibrant domestic league that everybody who watches and is engaged by football in this country is engaged by. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea of having a major tournament here. I thought it was one of the great blows. And I know we don't want to talk about COVID anymore, but one of the great blows of the COVID time was when the Euro matches were taken away, and people seem to think, oh, it doesn't really matter now. But I honestly felt it was even more, because Ireland weren't in it. It would have been something to look forward to during the dark months, to have those matches, and they would have meant something. And I think they are a kind of a thing that people would enjoy. Mm-hmm. Whether that's enough of a reason to have them, whether it justifies the cost, is another thing. But the idea of it being something that we should just dismiss out of hand, I feel, isn't necessarily the way to go either.
Yeah, I'm very open to the discussion. I think generally there's a fairly hardened skepticism towards these kind of ventures because, well, in particular in football in this country, we've been so underserved for so long that there is a sense this can't be the priority, hosting Euro 2028 games to line the coffers of UEFA. And also there's a scepticism, I suppose, that for the Jonathan Hills of the world and those up the corporate ladder and the various corporate ladders, and include, say, politicians, this is just a nice thing to have on their CV. Look what I did. I brought a Europa League final to Dublin. I brought Euro 2028 matches to Dublin, and that would suggest I'm doing my job well. And again, there's a scepticism over that. I suppose what leaves me open to the discussion more so than other ventures is it doesn't seem at first glance that this will cost a huge amount of money. If we're talking Croke Park and we're talking the Aviva Stadium and a casement is already going to be redeveloped as is, we're not here embarking on a crazy plan to build white elephant stadiums or spend a huge amount of money on infrastructure. It does look at first glance like Ireland would be able to host these matches without spending a fortune and without, you know, wasting too much time thinking about it. You know, your point there about thinking of strategy and more important things. So it always gets vague with the, like, does it make money? Does it lose money? I mean, generally these things find a way of losing money despite the best plans and the best projections. But this doesn't seem like complete and utter waste and hollow to the core. It seems like it's a bit more manageable.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not. It's not a desperate money pit that. As you say, like most of it is done, and that is the way, you know, a lot of, and you look at the Euros, that's the way, look at how the last Euros was initially modelled across Europe for, you know, for reasons such as that as well, because the idea of actually one country shouldering the entire burden seemed too much for them. And I think it there doesn't seem to be, you know, it isn't a huge, there will be costs, there will be more costs than whatever people budget for or claim it can be done. And the expectation and the idea, like we saw this around the America's Cup, where people throw out ridiculous figures about what this will bring to, you know, to a country or to an area. Mm. And, you know, you would see the same for any tournament. But, there would be, that isn't really the key thing. It is something probably a bit more intangible. I also, and when it comes to the America's Cup, I was glad to see that the Euros was referred to the third biggest sporting event in the world, because people tried to claim that for the America's Cup, the biggest scandal of the lot of that whole issue was to claim that was the third biggest sporting event in the world.
Is there any talk that Dublin might get the final, or does Wembley feel things went so well last year?
I think, well, it seems to be, FA seem to be confident enough that they've got past that they can
I bet they do.
But it's I think they would be looking, and it would be interesting, like, how they how it is broken down, because, you know, I take your point about the stadiums that are going to be used, but equally you would like to think that if it is Five Nations, that there is some attempt to kind of vary it a bit more than getting three matches and a quarter final or something like that. Yeah. It needs to, you know, but that could be the way it goes, with it being very, very, very heavily skewed towards England. But I also think, Joe, like, your point is interesting, and again, it does feed back into the strategy. Like, there is such a, it is interesting. Like, there is completely justifiably such a hardened skepticism about football administration in this country. And it is, looking at the various things today, from the announcement this morning, yeah, to the strategy document, and looking at some reaction and my own reaction and everything. And it's hardwired in all of us, really, to be incredibly skeptical and kind of dismissive of everything that the FAI kind of puts their name to. And this does predate, like, you know, the other dysfunctional bodies called the Galacticos and the perpetually exploding clown car and all these phrases that were used by the FAI. They predate John Delaney. You know, this is the thing. Like, there is no... the last few years have been really, really terrible for the FAI, but the reputational damage to the FAI is is almost as long as the association itself. And, you know, it is interesting to see, you know, they're talking about changing the logo and things like that. But I like a rebranding of the whole association.
Yeah.
Is probably no harm like that. There are certain aspects of that strategy where I'm looking at it and thinking, you could probably, you know, there are a lot of areas where you think it could be more adventurous. And that is possibly one of them, because it does, it did strike me again today just how tarnished it is and how long the road is going to be back, or not back even, because there's no back. This is the point. Like, there's no back. There's no golden age for the FAI. There's nothing really they can hark back to. So it does need a complete reinvention.
Well, let's move to the strategy launch then this evening. So this was done on the FAI's YouTube channel, and the strategy document is out there for everybody to read. It's very professionally done. It's very shiny. I had a chance to read some of it this evening, but not all of it in its entirety. And you may have had a chance to look at the launch on the YouTube channel. Just to give people a sense of the tone, I suppose, of that launch this evening, here is a clip of the FAI CEO, Jonathan Hill, just talking about the strategy in broad terms.
And this isn't just about the next 1 year or the next 4 years. To a degree, this is setting us up for success for the next 100 years as well. We're incredibly excited about that prospect. And look, having said what I said earlier in relation to consulting with all of those various people across the Irish football community, be they volunteers, be they administrators, be they referees, the most important thing in this strategy is that we are looking to improve the lot of our players. This is about playing football, the simple joy of playing football, and we hope that this strategy gives us a roadmap and a vision to be able to achieve the best that we can for all of our players within Ireland.
We'll get into some of the detail here. The future of the women's game is a big part of this report, so here's Hill talking about the vision for the women's game.
Our women's game has never been stronger. Katie McCabe and her teammates are an inspiration to every girl in Ireland and deserve every accolade that has come their way in recent times. While our Women's National League is growing and growing in stature and quality. As a board and an association, we are working very hard to ensure that inspiration is matched off the field. And to achieve that, amongst other things, we must develop and deliver programmes, both in clubs and schools in particular, to attract young girls to our game and work with all involved to ensure we retain those young players and offer them the best opportunities to develop their skills, which in turn will grow participation levels across both girls and women's football.
So that's a sense of Jonathan Hill this evening. Dion, just for people who haven't obviously seen the report or the YouTube launch, I'm just going to list off some of the headline aims and targets which caught me. And then by all means, if I leave anything out, jump in with what grabbed you. So you mentioned there's going to be a new logo, new identity, not entirely sure what that means, new values. In terms of the men's senior team, the big initial aim over the next 3 years is qualification for Euro 2024. For the senior women's team, they're to make the World Cup in 23 or the Euros in 25. They want both men's and women's teams, seniors teams, ranked in the top 30, and they want underage teams in the top 20. Another aim is to secure a primary sponsor for the men's team. A lot of talk about the League of Ireland. So a new brand identity is what they say for the League of Ireland by 2023. Again, the details of which, hard to know what they mean by that. But they do promise an audit of facilities with infrastructure plan to start next year. They also want the League of Ireland ranked in the top 30 leagues in the UEFA coefficient. It's currently at 40. That would be a big jump. They're going to bring in a third tier for the Men's League of Ireland in 2023 and a second tier for the Women's National League in 2025. They want to bring a Europa League final to Dublin in 2024. And then to elaborate on some of the themes for the women's game, there's a lot of 75s in here. I don't know, is that a deliberate thing or not? They want 75% attendance minimum for the senior international team. They want 750,000 people watching the women's senior team on television. And they want 750 clubs nationwide to offer football for to girls and women. So currently, instead of 750, there are 530 clubs in that position. And I suppose in participation rates, they're looking to have 300,000 registered players by the end of 2025. That would mean an increase of 50,000 female players and an increase of 28,000 male players. So currently we have 22,600 female players registered. They want to up that to over 75,000. And they're just some of the aims which jumped out. Now, how they're going to do all that, we can talk about in a second. But that kind of covers the report, I would think, unless I'm missing anything.
No, I think it's like a lot of these things. Like I was looking back at the 2016 strategy document last week, and again, you know, clearly there's a difference in tone between John Delaney and Jonathan Hill. But again, even with that, there are like lots of similarities in certain of the vague abstract aspirations. Like, you know, Jonathan Hill said we can bring football together like no other sport. Like that was one of the great themes of Delaney, who, you know, went into that 2016 strategy document talking about football being the people's sport. And but Delaney, of course, went further. He did actually compare. Said it was great that it was he compared I think it's great that I was looking to get this right. It's great that 100 years since 1916 that we'll hopefully have new sporting heroes 100 years later. So he linked the men and women of 1916 to the Irish football team going to the European Championships, which was something Jonathan Hill wouldn't try and do. But the general abstractions are kind of the same, but again, coming from a very low base because of what the FAI has been through. And there are a lot of things that jumped out. I think there are, again, like, you know, I watched most of it, Joe, and, you know, it's painful enough watching. Like it isn't something that you would really sit down and say, this is an entertaining watch.
Is it Jonathan Hill just at a screen or?
He was introduced by Cathal Derwin. He's at a podium, and then there was a little discussion with Roy Barrett and Paul Cook, and then Jonathan Hill again joining in, and it was all fine. It was all fine. It's just not particularly exciting, and Jonathan Hill isn't an exciting communicator. But does any of that matter? Like, this is the thing, you know, again, there's an instinctive response, and I include myself in this, to have a kind of eye roll at whatever the FAI are trying to do. And that is hardwired into us for very good reasons, but you know, I don't remember ever, you know, being blown away by anything Philip Brown has ever said, you know, or like being sort of taken on a voyage by the rhetoric of Philip Brown. You know, it's not really in the skill set of a sports administrator, really, and it shouldn't be. But for some reason, the FAI has this, and again, a lot of this does predate John Delaney, but John Delaney took it to new levels. It does have this sense where we look upon it as for good reasons, it has been this object of ridicule, and that is a huge thing for them to overcome as they go forward. But I think so. The point I'm getting to with this is that actually, as I kind of, you know, found myself sitting through this and going, is this any good? I then kind of felt sort of a bit more charitable towards the FAI in terms of what are they trying to do. Like, they can't come at this from this point where they are with really huge ambitions. Like, they really can't. Like, you know, you mentioned one of them there. Like, one of their goals is to get a sponsor for the men's team in 2022.
Yeah.
Like, it's extraordinary that that hasn't happened. Like, it is really extraordinary that you have this incredibly incredibly sponsorable, exciting, dynamic, young, vibrant senior men's team, and it's still without a sponsor. Like, that is extraordinary. So, like, that is something. And, you know, you look at their KPI for, you know, how we will measure our progress for that is, you know, primary partner, secure a new primary partner for our men's national team, key performance indicator, new partner to be secured in 2022. So, like, that is
a logic very, there. Like,
yeah, yeah. But it's, and, you know, that is kind of one of the clearest statements. A lot of them, as you say, there's, you know, it's vague in terms of, and it's very much in corporate speak in terms of what they, you know, going to do. Like, you know, there's, you know, with the League of Ireland, it's kind of, you know, support the League of Ireland in terms of doing well, support League of Ireland clubs in terms of doing well in Europe. And it doesn't really get into the detail of that. But I think beyond that, there are certain aspects that I found interesting, like the idea, and it's in the document, and Jonathan Hill said it in his address as well, is like, work with all our stakeholders to develop a football industry in Ireland. And there's talk in the full plan, it is, you know, work with clubs to create a talented, engaged, skilled and experienced full-time workforce in both business and football positions, including players, as we work towards creating a full-time football industry.
Yeah.
Now, that is actually kind of a huge ambition for where Irish football is at the moment.
And sorry to interrupt on that, because that is so crucial. Again, on my scanning of the document this evening, there was too much vagueness on that front, because we're at a precipice here of having to develop our own talent for the first time ever. Really, we have no industry on that front. And so it seems Jonathan Hill and the FAI are certainly against a Lillishall type setup or a residential academy which would oversee the development of the best however many players in the country, that it does seem to be very much wedded to handing that over to the League of Ireland clubs. And again, there are just so many question marks there over the capabilities of various League of Ireland clubs to follow through on that, on the number of coaches. There's a mention of certified academies or coaching accreditation, but again, it's vague. And just to give people a sense of the acrimony on the ground, because it is all very well in a document to talk about stakeholders coming together and holding hands and being best friends. You know, Dan McDonald pointed out in his piece in the Irish Independent that just the past week, you know, because this has been going on for a while, this business of, well, the national leagues at underage level are going to develop the talent and that's the best way to do it and we're sure of that. But this conversation has been going on for years at this stage. And just this week, to quote Dan, the FAI board's decision to delay the start of the under-14 National League until the summer has caused consternation in every quarter. League of Ireland clubs had already agreed in principle to take players from their schoolboy teams, and the majority of those players have gone through with their moves anyway, meaning that the schoolboy sphere is furious and nobody is satisfied. SFAI Honorary Secretary Martin O'Hanlon resigned last week, citing this episode. So for all the talk of aspiration, years into this situation, we have a bunch of 13, 14-year-olds who've made the decision to go to League of Ireland clubs, left their mates on the other team, and now there's no National League for them right through until the summer. And needless to say, the schoolboy teams are furious. Probably got a bunch of 13-year-olds saying, what the hell's going on here? Where are the adults in the room? Meanwhile, yeah, fair enough, we've launched our document this evening to say we're all going to work together, and that's the hope. But reality on the ground constantly seems to be different. That's one of the reasons for scepticism generally, but in particular on this issue. This sets the agenda for the next 20 years of men's senior football. And look, I think we're all very
nervous.
But
is there any
nervous.
Document, Joe, is there any document? Like that decision is baffling. Like, there's no way you can justify that in terms of what the FAI said they were trying to do, the manner in which it was done. The whole thing is just it's just illogical. Mm-hmm. It's really illogical, even by the standards of FAI, illogical decisions. It was, you know, it's up there. It's really up there again in the top five illogical FAI decisions. Like, there is nothing you can do about that. You can say otherwise about that. And, you know, and I take the point, like, when you have that still happening, like, what does it say about
it's reality versus the shiny document.
Yeah, but the reality is, Yeah, I know. I understand that. How would you, if you were like, the reality in Irish football is always very, very messy. Like, it is this extraordinary, like somebody described it to me last week as like, you know, it's a nest of vipers. And I think that has always been the case. Again, the under-14s and that the delay of the season, I mean, that doesn't really, like, people getting worked up about that, it's entirely legitimate. But no matter what decisions are made in Irish football, there is always warring,
yeah,
there are warring groups and lobbies, and it has been like that forever. You know, it has really been like that forever. And I was struck by, I've struck by a comment actually John Hill made on Twitter this evening, when somebody pointed out that the KPI for the League of Ireland shouldn't be, I think their KPI is a sold out men's FAI Cup final by 2025, and somebody said it should be to grow. It should actually be 20% growth in gates.
Yeah.
Which actually would be a very, that seems to be a much more, that would really be a much more tangible sign of improvement in the League of Ireland or growth. And Hill has just replied saying it's a very fair challenge and one we can address and integrate into specific League of Ireland WNL plans. Mm. Of course, this needs to be a shared objective with the clubs, and the help makes the point that in so many of the areas, the strategy can only succeed where the approach is collaborative. So, given the history of Irish football, you could say that any strategy that is based on the idea that it can only succeed if it's collaborative is doomed to fail the minute it's launched. Because collaboration and cooperation have never really been at the heart of an awful lot of things in terms of Irish football. It's always been political. It has, under the time of John Delaney, it was the politics was ramped up by John Delaney. He thrived on it. But it has always been that. So, like, this is the problem. This is going back to your point, like, there is, not just on the issue of the under 14 league, but on so many issues, there is nothing really that a strategy document can do to solve a number of the problems.
Sure. Yeah. Where you might be most hopeful and most charitable is the aspirations for participation. And, like, that shouldn't be discounted, the effect that can have on everybody's lives. And, you know, they note in the document there are 80,000 volunteers in football in this country. It's a wonderful thing. You know, I grew up playing football and it enriched my life massively, and there's so many great people there, and God, people love their football. If we can get 750 clubs offering football to girls and women as opposed to 530 within 3 years, if we can add 50,000 female players, add 30,000 male players, you know, these are very significant things as well. And I thought, well, great. I mean, I'd love to see how they're going to do it, but I think it's a great aspiration. And what really catches my eye is the audit of League of Ireland facilities with an infrastructure plan starting next year. Now, step one to gate receipts going up 20% across the board is an improvement in facilities, I think. I think the football is of a sufficient quality that people can go along and watch lots of good players playing good football. I think facilities can put lots off. So now, where the money's coming from, how all that's working, I don't really know. But these are some of the aspirations, which I think, accepting the certain scepticism we have for many good reasons, these are things that I'm very encouraged by.
Yeah, I think that they are encouraging, and again there is, like, this comes back to the many different aspects of football in this country, that there is a huge appetite for it.
Yeah.
There's a huge participation in it, and how that then can be translated into creating a more vibrant, you know, really getting the League of Ireland, getting the support its supporters feel it deserves, growing it, doing all those things, is how you join it all up is the thing. Because I think it's unfair, even on you know, Irish supporters get called, you know, bar stoolers or sort of event junkies or whatever, all this kind of stuff. And again, there is this tendency to blame to blame the supporter, the spectator, for not going to see the things you feel they should be going to see. No one in any sphere, walk of life survives by blaming the person they want to kind of, you know, the customer, if you like, for not buying their product. But there is a way to that through the participation and getting that right. And again, look, Joe, we go back to the same stuff. And this is why I actually do feel a little bit of kind of feeling charitable towards the FAI in some ways, because, you know, so much went wrong during the 10 years, the 10 years to 2019, and going back to the Vantage Club and going back to what clubs and what football clubs in Ireland were asked to do to make up for that that gap in the finances and the money, where the money went. And, you know, we know all the stories and how that took money from the things that we're talking about in terms of participation, coaches, all that kind of stuff, which is central to it. And if they feel that maybe there's an idea, there's a quick fix somehow, to go back to what we're talking about, like by bringing in Euro 28 or something like that, you actually have a quick fix in terms of galvanizing a country around something. But like, ideally, this is the stuff that changes, and it changes slowly, but it does need money, and it really does need. And I think, like, if I was somebody coming into the FAI today, I'd be saying two things. I'd be saying rebrand it entirely, change the name of it so that it's harder for people, you know, wedded to cliches like myself, to just come back in and refer to all the old lines about the FAI. Change it completely. And also then look at this team. Look at what you have. Look at the excitement around the Irish men's team now, and think, this is an opportunity to market everything in terms of what's coming through. Not just market the men's team, not just get a men's sponsor, but market the League of Ireland in terms of how these young players that you're going to see playing for Ireland for the next 10 years, that this is where you see them. Into this, to just link all that vibrancy together. And then you could actually capture the appetite of the people who are out there desperate, I think, actually, for, to really engage with football in this country.
Dion, great stuff. Great to have you on. Just out of time. Thanks a million. Dion Fanning there, Associate Editor at The Currency. We'll take a short break. And our football coverage is with thanks to Sky. Ironically, don't miss Burnley Man United on Tuesday night live on BT Sport, which is obviously, again, a huge part of football in this country as well.
The Football Pod on OTB Sports.
It's unreal. Evening is getting longer. Football National League is back. Good times.
Look at this. The positivity train. Go back, Jimmy.
The Football Pod is available every Tuesday, exclusively on the OTB Sports app.
Now, you're very welcome back. So if you're listening in Senegal this afternoon, today, of course, is a public holiday, which has been declared on the back of their Africa Cup of Nations success in a penalty shootout against Egypt. Sadio Mane, very happy man. Mo Salah and Egypt, not so happy. Second time in a row they've been pipped to the title. To discuss all, we are joined by a winner of this tournament, former Cameroon international, Joseph Ndo. Joe, great to have you on.
Hi, Joe.
So, let's start with the final. Up until the penalty shootout, this was not the greatest game in the world, I think it's fair to say, nil all.
Yeah, but I think we have some great individuals, and then also you have... it was very tactical, because when you see the way Egypt is playing, Egypt always try to control the game. You can see how much they waste the time. I think they are very good on that. Even when I used to play with them, even in clubs, when we played the African Champions League, they are so experienced how to control the tempo of the game. Mm. And I think Senegal have done well by trying always to up the tempo.
So you used the word technical there of Egypt style. I think a lot of us would say there's nothing technical about wasting time, about getting the ball out of play far too often, about killing the game, in effect. It might be utterly professional, but for me, there's no technical greatness to that. Like, I was reading Jonathan Wilson, for instance, who writes for The Guardian, and he described Egypt's play as anti-football in its truest sense. It's not that they defend, it's that they actively try to prevent any football being played. I think you're being maybe a bit generous to Egypt. Do they not have players to produce more quality football? No.
No, it's not. When I say I have, I say they were technical individuals. So now when it comes to the game, you try to do the best you can. Who are going to suit the majority of your players. And I think Egypt is playing with Israel, because most of the time, the way I see is that Senegal, with the player they have to play a certain way. And Egypt, the thing is, when you don't know Egypt, then it's a little bit strange. But we all know Egypt. Like, that's not new for us. Do you understand? Mm. So we all know how they play, and we all know how they are good at what they are doing, because that's another thing. I cannot ask Egypt to change their mentality about the approach of the game when it gives them results. And I think what the Senegal done better than Cameroon is that they keep the tempo. Mm. Because that's something Cameroon didn't do. And I think it's very important to understand it. You know, I love passing football. I love players expressing themselves. But I also understand that the football is not just the way I feel it. I have to respect the other people's vision of football. Mm. But when I go against them, you know, I'm not worried about what they're going to do. I put everything on what I'm going to do. And I think Egypt, and especially also because they played on Thursday and they have the final on Sunday. And for them, I think they felt that, listen, it's going to be difficult to keep up the tempo. Mm. And they find Is it my kind of football? No, but I respect because they are good on. At least they have a player who can play, who can do that.
Yeah. So am I right in saying that in your heart and in your soul, you don't look forward to watching Egypt, but in your head, you can respect the approach and understand the approach? That's maybe how we might split the difference here.
The one thing I will say that if you play against Egypt, you know what to expect. So it's going to be up to you to control the game. Mm. Because wasting time, I think, where do they learn wasting time? It's in European League. Because most of the time, when you see European... when a team in Ireland is playing against European team, the European team, they have so much experience. They know how to control the game. They know when to waste time. They know when to go down. So they're very specific. And when the referee, because that's another thing, during the game, I saw many stopped, many fouled, that the referee, of course, he whistled the foul, but he didn't give the yellow card. And I think that also, that was a little bit, for me, that's why I felt that, okay, Egypt, they have to play their game. But the referee, because if he give you yellow once, you're going to be careful the second time. And I think many times Egyptian player went away with that.
Mo Salah can't be happy playing that style of football.
I think Mo Salah is very happy to play that football, because that's where he grew up. So he know exactly the way they play. And at the moment, I would say one thing is that they are not as clinical as they used to be. Because in the past, if they have two chances, they're going to put one in. Mm. And the game is over. I guarantee you the game is over. And in other hand, is that when they concede one goal, it's difficult for them to come back. So
do you think, Joseph, that this is the right approach, or do you not think there is more ability in this Egypt team to play a better style of football, to play a more attacking style of football, to score more goals? Do you not think Egypt could do that, especially with a player like Mo Salah in their team? Because this business of pragmatism, to the degree that they take it to, just seems like a very reductive style.
But Joe, who's the manager?
Carlos Queiroz.
So I think that's.
But I'm criticizing the manager. I think that I would associate it with this manager, and I think it's an argument against this manager. That's basically what I'm saying. I'm being critical of him.
That's what I'm saying, is that for the manager, if the things are working out, like personally for me, I know how to beat Egypt, so I don't mind what they are doing.
Mm.
Because we play against them so many times, and we understood. Because the first thing about Egypt is that you have to dominate them physically. I think that's the first thing.
Right.
And if you cannot do that, it's going to be difficult for you to win. They have to feel that, listen, here today, even we are wasting time, we don't have a choice.
Yes.
So they always struggle on that aspect first. Because when you start dominating them physically, then you force them to play the technical football because they are very technical. I guarantee you on that.
Right.
But based on the manager, the way he asked them to play, because the main thing is what? It was like, we're going to protect everything because we know that Salah is going to have one chance. So if we can go through the 90 minutes without conceding, we may have a chance in penalties. But that's not down to the player, because I know for a fact that they are very technical players. Very technical players.
Right, interesting.
But all depends of the manager, the way I'm going to say, the way they play, I think, in 2000 was completely different the way they play now.
Right.
Of course, they were wasting time. But they have higher possession of the ball. And they were wasting time when they are 1-0 up. Because when they are 1-0 up, they know how to manage.
Mm.
But then now I think they have that, I will say, prudent approach to say, listen, it's better not to do too much and go to the final than try to play expansive football. And but they have a player who can play that expansive football, and I think also that will help Salah. So at the moment, the system is not based on Salah.
Mm.
Maybe they think that it's based on Salah, but it's not based on Salah, because Salah's game is based on ball possession. It's not based on defending without the ball. That's not possible. He needs the ball all the time.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I put it to you that I find it hard to believe that Salah enjoys this style of football. I'm sure he has great pride playing for Egypt and loves playing for Egypt, but it just seems like a great waste of one of the great footballers to play this style of football. It's such a waste. Do you know what else is a waste? Let's stay on that point. Okay. We go with this very, very, very miserable brand of football, and then we get to penalties. And then we don't even let our brilliant footballer take a penalty. I mean, at this stage, I just give up. I'm walking out of the room.
You're on fire today. I need to speak to someone in Egypt. You say, Joe is not happy.
I'm really not happy.
But I think what their plan was, Salah going to take the fifth one and we're going to win, because they felt that the keeper going to save maybe two or three.
Yeah,
but I told you again.
And how did that work out for them? Because I must have missed Salah's penalty.
He walked out against Cameroon, and then Senegal say, we learned our lesson. Salah will not take the penalty. But that's what I'm saying, Joe, that maybe for the staff or the manager, he thought that he based everything around Salah.
Yeah.
But he didn't use, because with Salah on the pitch, he shouldn't go in penalties. That's not possible.
And once they do get to penalties, Joseph, do you think it was Salah's decision to be fifth, or do you think the manager said you should go fifth? I suspect it's really Salah wanting to go fifth and kick the winning penalty, no?
I don't know really, but because I think it worked out so well against Cameroon.
Mm.
You know, so, and to be fair, the fifth penalty is always the hardest one.
But to interrupt you rudely, it often...
No, you didn't interrupt me.
Okay, to interrupt you politely, it so often doesn't get to the fifth penalty. Yeah. And for me, so look, Jamie Carragher, for instance, to give you a sense of what others in the footballing world had to say, Jamie Carragher said after the shootout, he said, that is why your best penalty taker should never go fifth. Mo Salah not taking a penalty for Egypt in a shootout is madness. And it happened to Ronaldo years ago.
I don't really agree, Joe. Why? Because they done it against Cameroon. And by the way, it's not Mo Salah their best penalty taker. I forgot the name of the first one. He always take the first penalty.
Okay.
I think that's the best one in Egypt. So it worked out. But when it comes to penalty, you see, the way we are seeing as who's going to take the penalty. But it's not the way Egypt's seeing. Egypt's seeing as how many penalty our goalkeeper going to save. Because they are so confident of that goalkeeper that even when he's injured, he's playing. Mm. So they don't look at the way we are looking at. We're looking at who's going to take. They're looking at how many is he going to score. So for them, they are guaranteed that he's going to score, he's going to save at least two penalties. That's what I'm saying. I think we are too... The way we are seeing football is so much different. When we are seeing us and the manager, it's so a way apart. Because we're seeing as who's going to make a difference on the pitch, but he sees as how many penalty my goalkeeper going to save. So if he save one or two penalty, I will not need to put too much on who's going to take the last one or the fourth one.
Okay, I hear you. And I take into account what you're saying about the goalkeeper being good. That said, it seems to me like just common sense. And this is the thing in football. We've seen, like, Ronaldo didn't take a penalty for Portugal because he was fifth and it never got that far. We've seen this tendency in football before where the big name is fifth on the list and never gets around to taking a penalty. And that is, as Jamie Carragher said, it's madness to not have... Okay, you're saying... Salah might be second best penalty taker, but for me it just seems, however good your goalkeeper is, it seems mad not to have your best four penalty takers guaranteed to take a penalty. Most penalty shootouts end before the fifth one, or a lot of them do. So I'd say to Salah, okay, go fourth, make sure we just want to make sure our best 2, 3, 4 penalty takers are first in line, and hopefully our keeper saves the day and brilliant, we win. But to have him fifth and to risk him not taking a penalty, this is another big issue with Carlos Queiroz. But I do wonder, I do think Salah maybe wanted to go fifth and maybe have that crowning moment, I think.
It's the same with Sadio Mane. That's another thing, because as, you know, the top players, the way they see, they don't see us. The goalkeeper gonna save four penalties. Mm. They see the goalkeeper may save one, and I'm gonna have to take the last one. Because to be fair, so to take the fifth penalty when the keeper already saved one, and you are the one who has to crown your team,
yeah,
is a huge responsibility. So the way the top player are looking at it, they always certain that, listen, he may save one penalty.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take the last one.
That's why I think go first or go fourth. They're your best odds. Go first or go fourth, I think.
Maybe they're going to change after that. But I think it worked out so well for them against Cameroon that it will be difficult after winning in penalties against Cameroon for them to change anything.
Yes, well, that's
because
a fair
that's
point.
That's another thing.
Yeah, no,
that's another thing.
Because that maybe explains their thinking. But I'm sure if you were in the same team as Mo Salah and you were going into a penalty shootout and he said, Joseph, I'm going to go fifth, I'm sure you would turn around to him and say, yeah, no, I think you should go second, third, fourth because I want you to take a penalty. No?
No, but Joe, we wouldn't go in penalty.
Be 5-0 up.
That's too much for us. No.
But you would, I'm sure you would say to Mo Salah, here, Mo, I don't think
that's another thing, Joe, is that, you know, when it comes to penalty, most of the time before the penalty, you have, I would say, seven takers.
Yeah.
And then of those seven takers, you have five who are pretty sure that, yeah, I'm ready. And then on those five, and I tell you the truth, on those five, you have certain players who cannot go in any number than the one they choose. So you have some players, they have to go the first.
Okay.
Other players, they demand to go second.
Okay.
And the manager, because what's happened is that when you are training in penalties, even in Cameroon national team, it was the same. We are doing penalties in training. And then he had those seven names or eight names. But before the penalty start, he asked, are you ready? Mm. Do you want to? Because it's important for the player to say yes. So do you want it? Yes. Do you want it? Yes. But then now they're going to tell you, okay, I want to go third. I want to go. And I don't see Mo Salah telling one of his teammates that, oh, no, I'm going to go third, because he's the one who has to always show the example. And he understood how much, because sometimes the player is scared to go last.
Fair
or
enough.
First.
Fair enough.
I think there's a two penalty where sometimes the player is scared to take the first one and the fifth one.
Okay. That's interesting.
Everyone wants the second, the third, or the fourth.
Okay. It's good to get the perspective of a player there. So fair enough, maybe there is that. But I tell you what, if on the basis of this conversation, if Egypt give me and you the job to take Egypt forward, then one, we're going to play more attacking football, but also yes, Mo Salah is going first, second, third, or fourth when we're deciding who takes the penalties, whether he likes it or not. And that's just...
I think he will go first.
Fine. Deal. Done.
Yeah.
A word on Senegal then. Were you happy to see them win? Do they deserve to win this title?
Oh, I was so pleased for them, especially for the manager, Lucy Cissé. You know, he got a team, I think that's his 7 years or 8 years, I don't really remember, and he got so much critics because of the top player he has under him, and he always comes short. And I remember, I think in 2002, when he missed a penalty against us. And I think for him to win on penalties, that's a big relief, because there is nothing worse, Joe, than you miss a penalty in the final. Mm. That's a nightmare, because that's going to follow you all your life. You're always gonna think that I could have. And that's why I said I was so pleased for him to be able to win that African Cup. And you know, it didn't start well for them. To be fair, it didn't start well for them. And for him to finish like that, I was so pleased.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, you know what a lovely feeling it is to win that tournament, so I'm sure they're having a good afternoon. Listen, Joseph and Doe, we are out of time. Really enjoyed the chat, so thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, Joseph and Doe there with his thoughts on Senegal winning the African Cup of Nations by penalty shootout. Sadio Mane kicked the winner, incidentally, and our football coverage is with thanks to Sky. Don't miss Burnley and Man United on Tuesday night, live only on BT Sport. We'll take a break.